Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's get to it, man. Another episode, another edition of the Knowing is Knowing podcast, as always. I didn't think I was going to go back to doing interviews, but my grandma has inspired me to go back to doing interviews, man, with people that I consider dope and always have something to bring into the world, but also really involve or indulge in deep conversation. And this person I got today, man, he's like a little brother. I used to call him my son, but obviously we're actually cousins. I keep forgetting that. But a very, very bright young man. When I want to learn something about, honestly, anything from politics to housing, redlining, education, man, his content really blows me away. I know it's just the beginning, man. He's actually, even though it's not done yet, it's not done. It's going to happen. He is going to do the audio version of my book. Or books at this point, honestly. I got another one to tuck, but books. And so my good brother, man, Caleb Hughes, man, how are you doing today, man?
Thank you for that wonderful intro. I'm doing well. Yeah. And I gotta say, I know all I know through different social sciences, thanks to a long list of good teachers, a long list of good social studies teachers and history teachers. So, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere.
I don't know, man. I mean, I know you want to give people credit, man, but it's hard to say. I'm interested in, obviously, I know you, but I'm interested in letting people know more about you and who you are, man, because you make content that is so different than most, I would just say, honestly, I would just say, like, the most Black people. Yours is very driven in education, history, but it's done in such a great storytelling way that is easy to follow along. So what got you to this path, man? What created these layers of interest? We can dive into more of the interests, but what got you into wanting to kind of, you know, tell your vision and kind of tell, you know, history and these things, you know, on social media? What got you into that?
For sure. Good question. I mean, honestly, since I was even little, my uncle Billy, he used to call me little professor. I always just like to be explaining shit.
Nah, for real. Yeah. It's okay, good, man. Free platform.
I used to always just love explaining shit. I'm just naturally very curious. I mean, if any asset is, you know, that's probably my greatest asset is just how naturally curious I am. And thankfully I was put in positions where I was kind of forced to think very critically about my surroundings. I went to schools like New City School that was very, you know, focused on teaching nonconformity. They're always like, you need to think outside the box. Some people will call it kind of like a holistic way of teaching. Some people will call it, you know, focusing on critical thinking. And it was both those things. Some people will call it derogatorily, like a school for hippies, like a hippie school. They're just trying to teach, like, you know, some alternative methods. But, you know, as we've seen with the way that I think a lot of our collective psyche, you know, has grown and matured, I think we're realizing a lot of people are finding, you know, information from different sources. And we're seeing the value of not necessarily thinking in a mainstream way. So my background definitely, you know, set some of that up for me. And for me, when I make my content and videos, just the way I think, I always try to, I think because of my background, I have a very diverse background, as far as, you know, the types of people I'm around, especially, you know, with black and white people, but even beyond that, on a race level, on a class level, on an education level. So because I've, you know, had to occupy what, I read this one text in this Wiz class I took. Actually, it was an intro level Wiz course. And I think it was La Frontera, the Borderlands or something. Let me pull this up real quick. You can cut this part out, but this is important. Anzaldúa, I'm definitely saying it wrong. Gloria Anzaldúa, and basically it's called La Frontera, Borderlands. And basically, I read like an excerpt of that for this Wiz course, yeah? And how that relates to, you know, how I think and how I approach my content is that she was talking about how some of the people that can, like, you can see a lot when you're at the border, when you're at kind of like, she says, the border or convergence or like the intersection of different things. When you're like, when you're on the outside looking in, sometimes you can see the inside, you know, clearer than what the people inside of it can see. And me, you know, being like growing up in a lower middle class income background and, you know, growing up in a mostly black community and then going to like, you know, different PWIs, private white institutions, you know, with lots of money, with some with not so much money, then others with lots of money. And then those each having its own kind of like, you know, diversity in some ways. Some of them weren't diverse in class, but they were diverse in race or, you know, where people come from. And basically what I'm saying is when you are forced to kind of like think outside of yourself, of course, that's the most basic. But when you're put at that border, and this writer speaks to her experiences, like, I think it's someone, I don't want to misquote it, but basically she's talking about white society, and she's also talking about like Latinx society and like indigenous society. And she's like, she has like an identity that's like, you know, at the intersection of all three. And, you know, plenty of people have studied this. I forget her name. I want to say it's Kimberly Crawford. Now that sounds kind of right. The lady, the black woman who put, I know you see poopy on it, the black woman who coined intersectionality. She kind of explained, you know, that advantage that you get when you're at the intersection, and basically how if intersectional thinking, you can learn so much from it, basically. So I try to, since my background is intersectional and I'm forced to look at and negotiate things, you know, from all different perspectives, all different viewpoints, it helps you with the final product. So when I think through things and when I make content, I generally, like, I try to think, like, how will my dad approach this, or how will my mom approach this, or like, you know, how will my grandma, you know, take this in, or how will my friend? And because they're all in very different stages, you know, of life and society, that is able to kind of, you know, give me a unique vantage point to kind of blend that all together. And I can always find the common denominator. That's something that me and my dad always say, what's the common denominator? Because then that's, you know, that's how you communicate. And that's how I try to make my videos, like, you know, simple, but, you know, complex at the same time, because you don't always need complex thoughts. You don't always need complex words to express complex thoughts. You can express complex thoughts with, you know, simple words sometimes. So it's all about finding, you know, the through line, the common denominator that's going to connect the most people, and understanding like what people are really feeling and how you can kind of, you know, tap into that. So that's guides everything I do, more than just the content, but you definitely see it in the content. So, and that's what I'm proud of, as far as, you know, something I made.
Yeah, no, I like that. I thought Poop was about to sneeze. That's why I said. It's weird seeing Kev.
She never spent as much time here, I swear.
I know. Like, it's because, you know, I think it's just like she recognizes that I'm here. We have a great relationship, so that's great. But I think the one thing that I've always, not even just like content aside, but just like in our conversations, I think we do have sometimes conversations like from a political standpoint. This really, the goal isn't to go into like a political spiel, of understanding how the world works. Because I think that we kind of both agree that, you know, parties and political parties are often discussed and or you're labeled based off of, my personal opinion, economics, like where you are economically in life. I think that's the main framework. But the other thing I want to kind of get into your thought is really mainly is like your perspective on classism and how it affects our world today. Because I mean, as we both kind of experienced, you know, you went to a great high school in St. Louis, arguably one of the best academically, but also one of the best from a financial standpoint as far as the type of kids that you're getting. And then you also went to a top 10 university in the United States and graduated from there too, though, man. And so having that. Yeah, you know,
not top 10.
It's not top 10. Top 15. Hey, man, you graduated from WashU, bro. I don't care what nobody said. That's still a win is a win. But my question is, you know, in those experiences, though, like, what was the biggest thing you think you learned about classism itself? Like, how do you think that affects so much of our world today? Like, we talk about it, like, from your perspective, like, how do you think it affects so much of the world today?
I mean, we could talk about classism for a long time. I'd say my head immediately goes to, well, first, I mean, for context, for people that don't know, WashU, when you talk about, like, income and family, and like, wealth and income, Amherst is first as far as the highest, like, student, like, you know, wealth, how much wealth and income they come in with. To the college, WashU is second. So second nationally in average student, like, you know, income. So, you know, what you saying is, you know, very true. Like, these are very wealthy people on average. Because a lot of them, a lot of them are coming from, you know, some of the most wealthy parts of the country. But yeah, my immediate, like, thoughts as far as, like, how class, like, what did I see with classism and, you know, things I say as far as things to learn and take away from it. Like, I think it's hard to know, and it's hard to overestimate how much you can be in a little bubble and how much it can blind you and how, you know, ignorant you can be of other people's experiences. I think, I think that it can, like, it's been long studied that, like, wealth can make you more, wealth can make you less empathetic, to other people. Coming from working class backgrounds, usually wealth can buy you certain convenience, and it also buys you, like, certain physical and mental distance and emotional distance from people. Some people seek that out. Some people don't necessarily seek that out, but it just happens to be a byproduct of money and wealth. And because of that distance, you start to empathize less with other people in general. And empathy, I mean, one of the pillars of, you know, society, the country, pillars of just, like, you know, human relations in general and love. So not having to have, like, that kind of relationship, to have, like, you know, people, you know, wanting to become more prosperous, more wealthy, and then also having, like, the outcome of that be, you know, lower empathy. That's a bad relationship. And that's something that we should understand, as a lot of us, you know, that aren't as wealthy kind of strive for money and wealth. Is like, okay, what is that, you know, kind of putting us in a position to do? So that's one of the most important things that I think about when I think of classism, is that I think of how much it can, like, self-reinforce your worldview and the type of incentives it puts in place for you and, like, you know, your behavior. To give, like, a hard example, I made one video and I was talking about how there was a study where they were tracking, like, eye movement of, like, you know, people from different classes or different wealth incomes, and people that were more wealthier consistently looked at other people less, just in general, just looked at people less, looked at, you know, the homeless person less, look at, you know, other people less. They're just, like, they're more tunnel vision. Whereas people that earn less or had less wealth were, like, were looking at other people more. You can make a lot of, you know, assumptions.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's based off of that, but I think it's a pretty easy and safe, like, understanding that that's not a good thing. You know, like, eye contact for a lot of people, not everyone, not every society, but for our society, eye contact is important. And it also is just like, it's a marker of like, I see you, I acknowledge you exist. You know, it's the base of anything else. Before you even talk to someone, you know, you're looking at them. That's one small indicator, but it shows you a lot, you know? And our intuition kind of already knows that, but that's just like one kind of hard example for you. I could definitely think more about other things I've learned from classes and just being at WashU. I mean, I think that people, another thing, everyone likes to think of themselves as middle class. I feel like that's a running joke. Like, you see, like, everyone, like, people could have like Moncler jackets and, you know, AP watches and like, you're like, oh yeah, I'm upper middle class. Like, no, man, you're in the 1%. But generally people don't really understand that. And I think your question is like, you know, it's a very important question, because like that exposes our lack of like understanding the differences and like the tiers of how wealthy people are, of the classes, the fact that we all think we're middle class, even though most of us, you know, middle class is like, you know, the small sliver, and we think is this many people. The fact that we think like, you'd be earning hundreds of thousands of dollars and you're not, you know, rich, like, it's just a disconnect. And it that also ends up to us not necessarily aligning ourselves to the types of policies and the types of solutions that we should be aligning ourselves to. That could be us not voting our interests. That could be us like thinking that, I don't want to vote for this person because they're going to raise taxes on the wealthy. I'm not the wealthy right now, but I'm trying to be the wealthy, you know? And it's this like, you know, you're voting against your actual, what might actually benefit you. Cause we all kind of, this is a big tangent, but we all kind of, you know, imagine ourselves as that rich person. Like, where there's a famous quote from this, like, you know, political figurehead in the 1900s. He was like, socialism never took root in America because the poor are too busy to seeing themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Meaning it's always like, meaning he's saying like, all the poor in the middle class, they're mentally, they think the same as the ultra wealthy. And they think that, oh, if I do X, Y, and Z, if X, Y, and Z happens, you know, and I catch a break, then I'll become that, you know, ultra wealthy, instead of kind of working within their own kind of political context, instead of trying to better, you know, instead of raising the floor, they're thinking, I'm just going to go straight, you know, to the penthouse one day, instead of improving the conditions at the lowest level.
I mean, I know there's so many layers, but I think you just said something, that quote you mentioned about pretty much the lower class thinking millionaires. I think that's interesting when you think about today's time. Because we talk about, I know we talk about economics all the time. It's just kind of how vastly, I think, false in thought and slight delusion of how many people actually think they're middle class. And when you actually look at reports, and I don't know the specifics right now, I think anything over 450,000 is considered wealthy and 1%. I think even in today's time with inflation and everything else, making $100,000 doesn't necessarily classify you as middle class, especially if you're living above your means. So what's the saying now? At least I've been told like that. Like the new $100,000, like probably make $100,000, even though it's considered six figures, isn't really six figures, depending on where they live at.
Right, especially because, well, you know, if that's in like one of the bigger cities, you know, that's not getting you as far, unfortunately. And then, I mean, to your point, it's the big difference between income and wealth, you know, because wealth can be like, you know, what assets that are passively getting you income versus like, you know, a wage is a wage. Like you could be earning, you know, $200,000-$300,000. That's a lot of money anywhere. That's a lot of money. But that can still be a wage. If you stop, say, if you, like you said, if you're living above your means and you don't know how to budget, and say you come from a family that, you know, has lower wealth, you could lose your job and you can be, you know, 2 months away from, you know, getting evicted. I mean, that's a very different reality than someone who, say, like low income, but maybe their family has a lot of wealth, and then they could lose their job and they always have something to kind of, you know, sit on. Like, wealth is still, there's a big, I mean, in wealth, what I'm trying to say is the gap and the focus should be on wealth more than income, even, because there's a lot of lawyers, there's a lot of doctors that, like, you know, like to think that they earn a lot of money, and they do. But their class interests, honestly, should be closer to, you know, other wage workers, other people that work for a paycheck, than it should be with the ownership class of those that own the wealth and, you know, can leave a job but have passive income in the background generating them more money. To go back to the kind of the classism, and it's just a lot of mental, like, misrepresentation and not really understanding where we fall.
No, I think that's the main thing. You always nail on the head, man. I think that's the biggest thing that I'm continuing to learn is, we are striving for something that is important, because wealth is important. And I'm not a financial advisor, so I, you know, my comments are just purely based off of observation. I always say that our biggest issue, I think, not even just from a Black perspective, but like a people perspective, is that we're often more consumers than we are owners. You know what I mean? So like, if we do take it from a race perspective, like Black people in America, we statistically are usually the larger consumers, or one of the largest consumers. And because of that, most of the consumption isn't based off of actual ownership itself. It's usually towards material goods, more of branding, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to just be like people buying designer clothes. It's just typically not towards ownership alone. And granted, we can always go down the truth of the hardships of what it means for somebody of color to have ownership, loans, anything. It's
exactly
four times harder. So we're not gonna sit here and say, oh, you know, Black people don't want to own anything, because that's not true at all.
And I will say, I saw a statistic this week that black investors, like, you know, there's been a higher growth than like expected, and us invest, especially the youth. And I'm not surprised, because when I look around me, I see a lot of that initiative, and I see a lot of us that, you know, have felt like we've been denied that, because we have. And I see a lot of, you know, like people like me and you and, you know, my friends that are like enlightened and seeing, you know, the path that having, you know, some type of wealth and investment offers, and to be more financially literate than often our parents are, and kind of, you know, ushering it into that new generation. So I do think, you know, some positive, you know, things are on the horizon, especially for us. I think the consuming part and trying to live within your means, that's the tough part, I feel like, for everyone.
It's always going to be tough, though, because inflation, you know, we can't, inflation is at an all-time high in every area. So, you know,
inflation is one part of it, but also just like, to me, like advertising is the other thing. I think I saw some statistics, like the average American sees, I didn't even know how this was possible, but like when you really think about it, it makes sense. It says something like 10,000 ads a day. That didn't seem right. But like when you think about it, billboards, logos, just like if you walk outside, you see so, you know, many things. And like, I mean, we live in it. So it's like we're accustomed to it. So probably a lot of it, you know, sips past the subconscious. But I could believe, you know, something like that. I mean, so much. And what I'm getting at with that is so much of like desire for what we might want is fabricated. It's fabricated. We don't really know what we want. I feel like we are kind of spoon fed, you know, through, you know, corporations and things of like what we should want. And capitalism and consumerism, you know, that I mean, our economy is kind of, you know, capitalistic, obviously, but it's very consumer driven. And all that consumerism is really led by a feeling of insecurity a lot of times, I feel. Because the most potent consumer is someone that's very insecure. Because what do all advertising, you know, try to do? It's try to convince us you don't have something right now and you need this to satisfy you. Whether it's food, whether it's entertainment, whether it's, you know, a beauty product, whether it's whether it's, you know, a business trying to pitch you to be a business person, you know, like it could get meta, like it could get a little abstract, but like it's always pitching you something of like you need to reassess like what you have right now and not be satisfied with it. I think that's why I remember I talked with it's a bit of a tangent, but I talked with this one urban design TikToker, social, you know, media content creator. And she did a lot of urban design stuff. And she was saying, like, you know, the nice thing about parks is, like, you can't monetize it. And there's all these, like, you know, when you, like, you can sell certain ideas of, like, oh, let's make this, like, area walkable. Let's make this, like, outdoor mall, this village or whatever. But, you know, the things that get traction are the things that, like, okay, how can I make money off of this? Some of the nicest things in life, you can't make money off of, you know, like having a park, like having like, you know, things for people to like kind of unplug and like detach from like, you know, things and materialism. Those things you can't commodify and you can't make money off of. So we see less of it in our society because our society, like I said, is so focused. How can I make this person spend some money on something? Unfortunately.
I don't know. That's the harsh truth. But let's, man, it was more so like I was curious to know, like, for somebody I feel like that's into politics, that's what I was getting to, into politics, what do you think is the biggest issue regarding all the various parties and their stances? Like I mentioned, we both agree that most of these people in their stances are usually typically either based off of how they were raised or a financial piece. And I was just curious to know, like, how you think that creates a lack of solutions to all these various problems in America.
Yeah. I say, obviously, big question, but I'd say the pound for pound biggest thing is just it's addressing inequality, it's addressing class, it's addressing differences in opportunity. Which has all come down to kind of, you know, the hard economic condition of people. I'd say fundamentally people aren't paid enough. People don't have enough money. I mean, the biggest thing is people don't have enough money. That's the most basic way you could phrase that. I could say that there's a housing crisis. I could say there's too much homelessness. I could say rent is too high. I could say people don't have enough money. I could say inflation's out of control. I could say the military has too much money. But all of that is, you know, the common denominator of all that is that people don't have enough money to work with. The solutions to fix that are, you know, the solutions to fix that, and, you know, to get to, you know, what you said about what's the difference as far as where conservatives are mentally at right now and where are the more Trump people at, and then where are Democrats and then more progressives, like where's everyone at? I think everyone in the room, metaphorically speaking, understands the issue that people don't have enough money and people don't have enough resources and that economics are not, you know, the hard economic facts like aren't good. Things aren't working. I mean, generally speaking, like, you know, the past 8 months or whatever, economically, haven't been that bad. It's not that we're in a recession or anything. I'm just saying, like, and it's not that things haven't been worse, like, you know, 4 years ago or anything. I'm just saying that in general, people don't have enough money. People are strapped for cash, yada, yada. And everyone in the room understands that. But people's solutions for that are very different. On the right, the Trump types, essentially what they're preaching, and a lot of what I'm saying is obviously, you know, from my own research and study, but a lot of it is from a book in particular, Capital and Inequality, by this very renowned, very well-regarded, like, French economist, Thomas Piketty. He had originally wrote this massive fucking book. I'm talking like 1,000 pages. It was like a research book, and it kind of going into like the quantitative stuff and, like, you know, math and economics and stuff. That was back in 2014, and it was called Capital, you know, like old fashioned, thick ass economics textbook, nitty gritty numbers and shit. And it was a long ass way, 1,000 page ass way of saying, look, in general, capital will tend to fuck up things. Capitalism will tend to fuck up things. Meaning, capitalism, you know, you hear it all the time. One quick way to understand the core of it, even though it's many things, the core of it is that it's trying to direct capital, people with machinery, people with lots of money, people with lots of assets, people with lots of resources, give them essentially the reins on our society and let them create things and then let the market work everything else out, roughly speaking. So basically, this big ass book says capital, in the long run, meaning, you know, over the course of decades, over the course of centuries, will tend to grow faster than anything else. And what he's saying is capital will grow faster than the economy in general. So basically saying a small minority of wealthy people will become stupidly rich. So he's essentially saying in 2014, the Bezoses, the Gates, like ultra billionaires, ultra wealthy people will become extremely wealthy way faster than general society will like progress. And he's saying all of that will happen under the best case scenario for what we call capitalism. So basically it was kind of a cat's out the bag. Here's this very academic person, very, like, at that point, central, like, kind of centrist, like, you know, not a socialist, not, like, you know, not on the far left, not on the far right, but a centrist academic, you know, supposedly, you know, the most objective person, most moderate person in the room, essentially saying, shit's not working. It's not going to work. We need to drastically change things. So centrist calling for radical solutions is essentially what that book was. And within the academic community, obviously it's very insular. That's why, you know, no one's heard of this book. that was a very popular thing. Fast forward to 2019, he creates a successor to that one called Capital and Ideology. That one I've read. That one's like 1,100 pages. Also thick as shit. But it's more about the solutions to that issue of, hey, capitalism isn't working. And he talks about, you know, he essentially takes progressive stances. He's saying, yes, we need to tax wealth at a higher rate. We need to tax the ultra wealthy at a higher rate. We need to close all these loopholes that corporations and businesses, you know, take advantage of, to not have to pay taxes, to not have to pay workers, to not be competitive, really. He takes progressive stances. Those are the solutions he offers. He talks about universal basic income and all those kind of things. And at that point, nowadays, those kind of things within the academic setting are kind of like well-respected and taken and seen as pretty popular. Basic income has been an idea since, you know, Martin Luther King came, you know, he didn't come up with it, but like he was a big proponent of it in the 60s. And
talking about universal basic income.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what are your thoughts on that? So sorry, like, what are your thoughts on this topic? Who's the guy? I cannot think of his name.
Andrew Yang.
Yes, Andrew Yang was the one that kind of presented that in the last running when he was running for office. Yeah. Do you actually think Do you actually think that would actually make a better economy?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the stimulus checks were the precursor or the preview for that. The economy did well with stimulus checks. People will tell you, people like stimulus checks helped ordinary people in a big way. And honestly, a lot of academics, or at least on the progressive side, were kind of pissed and disappointed that that wasn't just continued indefinitely. Honestly, because the political will was there for it. A lot of these things, like a lot of economics, there just has to be a political will to do something, and then things will get done. Like there's nothing like popular support. If people popularly support something, it will tend to get done. Or you'll face a lot of friction. Abortion is a good example. Abortion is, you know, like most people, 60% of, you know, Americans tend to favor with Democrats, tend to favor, like, you know, the right for a woman to have, you know, a power over the situation. That's why the Supreme Court ruling was so, you know, unsettling. You saw these huge protests because it was trying to reject something that was pretty popular. So popularity and like getting political willpower is like, you know, the name of the game. Universal basic income has that already. At this point, you just have, you know, the ownership class that is more against that, because that, you know, I mean, that's less of the pie for them essentially to control. But to go back to what I was talking about with the book, to answer your question as far as like, you know, what the solutions are, you know, to that issue that I outlined, that I think everyone understands, that, you know, people don't have enough money and people are struggling economically and there's not enough opportunity. The solutions that the different, you know, kind of groups of parties propose are well outlined in that book, Capital and Ideology. So Thomas Piketty kind of says, and I'll kind of like paraphrase him, basically, he's like, there's the Trump type of people. And the solution they're offering to that issue is, we'll just, we'll take, you know, this pie, this share of the, you know, the money, the economic wealth, we'll take the pie and then share it with fewer people. So essentially what they're pitching to their supporters is an exclusionary solution. They're like, okay, the issue isn't that, hey, we don't have enough money. The issue is, hey, you know, these immigrants are taking your money, they're taking your jobs. Or, hey, they're getting here illegally, they're ruining the economy, they're taking your jobs. Exclusionary. Or they're proposing, like, hey, it's all these, you know, diversity hires, they don't, you know, actually deserve anything, they're, you know, taking away from you. Or, hey, it's women, you know, it's basically, it's shrinking. I mean, this is a strategy of, you know, lots of different, you know, historical figures. I mean, you know, Hitler, that this was his strategy, was essentially to shrink the pie. The German economy was awful of suffering. It was like, okay, let's just make it for, you know, Aryans, for white people, for, you know, non-Jews, to make it just for, you know, very ethnically Germans. And essentially when you do that, you slowly strip the rights of everyone else. And that's what, you know, the Republicans are trying to do. They're slowly trying to strip the voting rights of Blacks across the country to make sure we, you know, we can't vote as easily, if at all. They're trying to, you know, get college students to vote less and make it harder for college students to vote, because they know that that's, you know, usually who doesn't vote for Republicans. Basically say the proposal, everyone understands the same issue. Once again, money is the issue. The far right proposal is, let's just make this pie and give it to a smaller percentage of people, which is white supremacy. You know, let's just give it to, you know, white people essentially, and especially white males. On the center right, the more conservative, you know, your Romney type or whatever, the solution to it is more muddled. It's not as straightforward. It's not as well communicated, which is why really the conservatives, they're not doing as well right now in the last 4 to 8 years, because things are pretty, because the public is pretty open to radical solutions because things aren't working. So, I mean, that's how you get Trump. That's how you get Bernie. That's how you get AOC. That's how you get Biden, you know, who started as a centrist, but Biden's essentially absorbed, you know, pretty much all the economic, policies of, the far left, because he's been forced to, because that's what, people have appetite for, that people want radical solutions. So that's why the central right, you don't really get a clear message of what their solution to the issue is. The center left, same issue. You don't get a clear, like, it's more the center right and left. They're still like, tied to the old guard, the like, oh, let's just keep trying the same things. That's honestly the Obama type, center left. Let's keep trying the same things. Let's, stick by capitalism and not really, change much. And that's why they're not doing as well, because their message is diluted. The far left, you got what, what I said earlier about, universal basic income. And ultimately, that's inclusionary. So we talk about diversity and inclusion all the time, and equity, and that's what that is. Like, you're including everyone into the pie, and that's what I stand for. And you're sharing, the wealth, and you're saying there is enough to go around. We can afford to do things like universal basic income. We can afford to, give people, all kids, better education, can afford to pay for people's health care, and can afford to, give, say, like, parents, equal parental leave for whether you're the dad or the mom. And and that all creates a more secure emotionally society and a more economically secure society. And it, like I said earlier, it raises the floor so that there's less pressure, so more people don't feel like they need to do extreme things and honestly kind of adopt, like, delusional thinking. Like, so you see all the grind, the hustle culture, the grind set, like, tunnel visioning in on trying to make it by any means necessary, and essentially living like pretty shitty lives based on this one, dream or delusion of like making it very big. Because you have so far to fall, people are more insecure. So that's, I'm definitely in line with the far left and progressive, and, some will call it the socialist side. And I mean, that is what this is. So, like, these are all, those are socialist policies. Like, universal basic income is a socialist policy, as in it's just like for, everyone in society in general.
Ooh, okay. That was good. That was a lot. I almost went down the wrong pipe for a second. And there's a lot. It's a lot that you were saying, though, that I definitely think makes sense. And obviously, if people see this and whatever, they have, people are going to have responses. I would challenge anybody that does listen to this to really have an open mind and heart. Please do not try to be defensive in your views, because that's what often curates these problems, is that people are so stuck high on what they think. It still goes back to the idea, and regardless of what people think about America itself, it does often try to attempt, from an advertiser standpoint, that it is a melting pot of opportunity and obviously diversity and things like that. Obviously, we have stances and thoughts, but it's the truth that, I think that these are the best ways to learn these things, is to actually sit down, actually learn, actually understand. So I definitely commend you for taking the time to read 1,000-page books, 1,100-page books on the economy. Because I do think that is one of our downfalls as people, that we do not take the time to understand how all this works, that we get so caught up in what we either been taught or what we think, and use it as our face value to determine our future. But again, it goes back to what I think about political stances and views. I think depending on where you are financially will definitely determine the type of stance you will want to have represent you. Now, you may not necessarily agree with the leader of that movement, but if they are doing what's in best interest for you, you're going to rock with it 9 times out of 10. I do have a final question for you, because I feel like you share it so much. And I think there's so much that we can always dive into. This could definitely be a Joe Rogan this episode was like 4 hours of
4 hour long. Damn.
4 hour ones. I'm sure he does. He definitely does. I think Kanye's is almost 4 hours. But I'm curious to know, because remind me, you're 23
as of yesterday.
23, yes. Happy birthday. Yeah. And so since there is a 5-6 year age gap between me and you, I am curious to know, what do you think about the next wave of young leaders? What do you think that they are going to stand for? Because even though we are close in age, I think that you all have a little bit of a more radical stance than we do. And I'm just curious to know, what do you think will be the biggest stances that y'all will want to stand on moving forward as far as cultivating the ideal society for us as people?
I mean, I would say always when answering a question like that, between, like, you know, identifying generational differences, a part of the answer might always, the mistaken answer that, you know, a lot of people might give, I'm not giving this, but I'm saying a quick answer that people will give, will be to judge people of my age group too soon. So, like, a lot of behavior is age dependent. So, like, college people are more radical and, you know, progressive, but that's also just a factor of the fact that they don't have anything that's, like, tying them to a situation. And so when you don't have responsibilities, when you don't have, like, you know, when you don't have kids, when you don't have property, when you don't have any ties to needing the status quo to continue to be the status quo, when you're not invested in society to be predictable, which really means you're going to, like, stand by the status quo within reason, then of course you're willing to, like, endorse more radical change. That's why change is all, that's why, you know, young people are always, you know, great vehicles for change, because they're not tied to, you know, the way things are, the system as it is. So I say that to say that I do think, I'm going to say there's two things that I think are, you know, relatively unique and that stand out, you know, for people my age. I think people my age on average, you know, compared to, I'd say, like, you and my brother's age, like, are more aware of climate change, are more aware of climate action, are more aware of, you know, the issues around that and the environment. And I'd say that we're also, you know, I just a hard fact of, you know, when we're, you know, born and when technology and social media and personal devices, you know, emerge naturally, we're folded into the digital world more than, you know, anyone else. So, like, those are hard, concrete things that I think are different. Our appreciation of how bad climate change can be, and our ability to use and also just understand, you know, the digital world and digital media, doesn't necessarily mean we accept it more. It just means we're, like, more embedded, you know, within it, because we've, you know, grown up with it for longer and during our, like, you know, maturing periods. That's why I think it's, like, definitely different. I think everything else, as far as our appetite for, like, you know, radical change, our appetite for, you know, I mean, also another hard example is we've existed in more diverse settings, I'd say, more than, you know, your guys' generation, because we've had, I mean, we're just further into, I mean, segregation has on desegregation. I mean, yeah, desegregation has only been, you know, around since, like, what, the 70s? Or really 80s, really, as far as when it, like, really, you know, kind of kicked in effect. So that's, so every 5 years, it makes a difference. Like, my little cousin, who's, you know, 12, like, I mean, no, she's 14, like, she's gonna have an even more diversified background than I will. Shoot, that's just a world that she's gonna be even more familiar with than I would, and me more than you. But that can always go backwards, you know. Things can change, but that's where the trajectory we're on right now. So I'll say diversity, climate, and the digital world, those are the hard differences I see. But everything else, as far as, like, oh, economic equality and economic justice, or, you know, adopting universal basic income and stuff like that, I think that's all just a function of where we're at in, you know, stage of life. So that could change. I think we're on the same page, you know, as your age group, and it just depends on how well we're able to, like, you know, kind of understand, you know, how things are operating in the bigger sense. And, you know, I mean, some people can get tied to the status quo. I mean, I've already seen friends that used to have more, you know, progressive views a year or two ago, and now they have a job, you know, that pays well. And suddenly a lot of issues aren't that relevant for them anymore, because, you know, having a lot of money, you know, can iron out a lot of issues to where, yeah, things might suck, but you are kind of insulated from that a little bit. So I can already see them developing into more conservative people over time. And I'm like, okay, in 10 years, I could, when you have kids, when you have property, I can see you being a much more conservative person than you were at your age right now. So that's something I can already kind of, you know, notice to answer your question. But I do think in those three things that I said earlier, those are things that I think are definitely different, and that those will be a lasting change even as we get older. I think those are things we'll always kind of keep in mind.
Yeah, no, man, that, hey. It's like, I just feel like I just went to school again. But you always, seriously though, man, I always say this. I mean, I'd rather have saying this on camera, off camera. I mean, I always feel like with you, you remind me how much more I got to learn. And I'm somebody who already likes to learn, but you are in a different, you learn, the things you learn about, I recognize I still have an ignorance with, and I haven't taken the time to really divulge into. And it doesn't mean I don't care about it. It just, it reminds me that there's always more to learn. So I appreciate the fact that you are so driven in your cause of learning and making content and being informational, and more so just being yourself, man. I think
for sure
that's the biggest thing that I've always respected about you, just making the content you make. You can easily go into the route of doing what's in the trends and all that, man. Yeah. And I think to be, again, a Black man that makes, I would like to say, educational and historical, educational and economic content with so much data and research, man, you have to, gotta give credit what it's due. And I just want to let you know that I appreciate that, man. But for those who do not know you, as far as your social media, where can people find you?
For sure. So I'd say TikTok. It's just my full name, Caleb Akeen Hughes, CalebAkeenHughes. Same with Instagram, and then LinkedIn as well.
It's been everywhere.
And yeah, there's a couple projects I'm working on.
What made you change the name, man? I remember, I swear it was like Observer. It was Observer Over Thoughts, right?
Yeah. Oh, it was that for a minute, but basically. Because, you know me, I mean, if I would like to be, you know, like an educator, or, you know, maybe run for, you know, for office one day. And both of those things, I would benefit from having, like, you know, a better name recognition. So, like, why not get my name out there from the jump? You know, I just figure for the types of things I want to be doing, it would be better if more people knew my name than less knew my name. So it just made sense.
I was like, dang, I was looking up his content. I was like, when did Caleb change his name to his name? And for somebody who uses their name for content too, I get it. It's like, I always say the best way to people to get to know about you, man, is just to know who you are and know your name, man. All the other
stuff. That's a personal level. And I feel like people respect that. I saw some tweet the other day. I don't even be on Twitter. I saw a screenshot of a tweet on Instagram. And somebody was saying the future of like influencing. The future of like social media won't be influencers, it'll be educators. And I really do believe that, because when I hear people talk about, like, oh, I was on TikTok or oh, I was on Instagram, I hear people say, oh, I learned this thing on this platform. And I think that's really telling. Or I hear, like, oh, I saw this funny thing on this platform. So I think humor and teaching, I think the lane that me and you are in, like, that's a, like, people respect that. And that's a very, you know, useful thing. Like, we all want information, we all want to learn. So yeah, thank you for, you know, making this podcast and doing what you do as an author.
Hey brother, you've been around for a while, man. You know, I've been doing this for a couple of years now, man. So I feel like I'm finally about to start hitting my stride. So again, we just trying to do something positive, man. Do something positive, but also show the talented people that I know, and hopefully get a chance to meet more talented people at some point, because that's the biggest goal, man. I think this is the last thing I do for a wrap up. Like, that's the biggest thing that I was learning when I brought this back. I was like, man, what was working? I was like, man, interviews were working. I'm like, people, you know, I had to kind of get back out of my own way because I think I was so big on, I want people to know me. Like, I want people to know me, what I got going on. Like, you know, and I still want people to do that, but I'm like, man, like, you also know all these dope individuals, man, that have something to represent.
Personally, I love the balance, honestly, because I want, you know, to know you. And I think both.
Yeah, I had to tell myself that. Honestly, literally after interviewing my grandma, I was like, you got to go back to interviewing people again, man. And I was kind of, I recognized I was a little stubborn about that. I'm like, but it's helping people helping you, man. You know, it takes a village to make these things grow and to expand, man. And usually the best pods are with interviews. Those be the best ones. The best ones. Learn something new again. People can learn about so much just with you and anybody else to come along, bro. So I appreciate you, man. This, as always, this has been a great episode. Make sure you subscribe to it on your favorite audio platform. Check this out on YouTube. Follow my brother on his social media pages. And as always, I will see you all soon. Till next time, peace.